Jeg heter Marit Kristine Odland. Jeg jobber på Høgskolen i Oslo Akershus på bibliotekutdanningen. Og det er så glede for meg å få ønske velkommen til dag 2 av kunnskapsorganisasjonsdagene. I går hadde vi et fokus på en del data som vi har tradisjoner for å kunne holde en slags orden på. I dag beveger vi oss over på datamengder og datatyper som vi ikke har den samme kontrollen over. Så da er vi over på kaos eller anarkiet. Vi skal ha en sesjon nå, før en kaffepause, med Helene Hoksju og Kjersti Rustad. Så blir det en pause, som jeg sa, og så har vi en sesjon med 2 stykk til før lunsj. Lunsjen er som i går. Vi går opp i etasjene og finner maten der. Så det burde gå som det pleier. But now, Helen.
Thank you. Can you hear me all right? Yeah. Okay. Good morning. Thank you for inviting me to speak here. Delighted to share some of my knowledge about web archiving. So I've been doing this for quite a few years, first at the British Library, since last September at the Internet Archive. So the title of this talk was inspired by the 2015 New Yorker article, The Cobweb, Can the Internet Be Archived?, which asked the question, where is the Internet's memory, the history of our time? Today I'm going to attempt to answer that question by having a look at the progress so far, highlight some key challenges, but also try to think loud about what we could do better together. I'm not going to talk about the internet. I'm going to talk about the attempt to archive the web, one of the key applications on the internet. So when I talk about web archiving, it refers to the systematic attempt to preserve and provide access to web content. And 2016 is actually the 20th anniversary of web archiving. So I think it's a good time to take a pause and reflect on the progress. So I'm going to start by giving an overview of the web archiving landscape. So the Internet Archive is the first who started web archiving in 1996. When we talk about historical web, I think Internet Archive's Wayback Machine perhaps is the most known because of its global scale and unrestricted access. It is by far the largest and oldest web archive in existence. We'll look into some details later on, but that is how web archiving started. In addition to that, there are actually quite a number of national web archives. So Chris Christie from the National Library of Norway is here today, who's going to present after me, so you can see how web archiving is done at national scale in Norway. But there are 30-plus national libraries who now have a web archiving program. And some national archives are involved in web archiving as well. And 20-plus of them actually collect the web as part of their legal deposit remit. And there are also government and corporate web archives. So I've given a couple of examples here. The UK government's web archive and the website archive of EU institutions. And the purpose, I think, between the libraries and archives, archiving the web are slightly different here, because one really is the goal for the National Library is to preserve national heritage, while for archives and corporate organizations, the purpose is to preserve records. There are also many research-driven web archives, mostly operated by academic libraries, universities. So there is for example, the Human Rights Web Archive at the Columbia University Libraries, and also the Digital Archive for Chinese Studies, which is a collaboration between the Heidelberg University in Germany and the Leiden University in the Netherlands, which focus on preserving Chinese website or websites relevant to Chinese studies, which are risking of disappearing because of, you know, known censorship issues. In addition to that, I think there are efforts of individuals and small groups which quite often respond to a particular cause. When a rapid response was required in order to save content that would have not been archived by any of the existing institutional programs. So the Daily ASCII Archive in Canada, for example, is and also the archive team led by Jason Scott at the Internet Archive has done quite a few things archiving, responding to sporadic events, trying to save content from the web. Because of the expertise and ongoing effort required to maintain web archiving infrastructures in-house, there are also web archiving service providers. So Internet Archive being one ourselves. So I'm going to talk about the Archivit service a little bit more later. There is also the Internet Memory Foundation based in France. I think one thing to note here is that for both of these service providers, their collections are open to everyone. And there are also commercial providers, such as Hanso in the UK. Their purpose is really to meet individual organizations' needs for, records keeping and litigation compliance, that sort of thing. And their archive normally is closed. When I describe the web archiving landscape, I think it's important not to forget to mention the IIPC, the International Internet Preservation Consortium, which currently has 49 members, I think, worldwide. So it is really a forum where national libraries and archives and others involved in web archiving to get together annually to exchange experience and lessons learned, and also there are attempts to collaboratively develop tools needed for web archiving. So we just had our annual gathering in Reykjavik in April. So next year it will be in Lisbon, I was told. So I do not intend to go into the details, but I think good and bad at the same time. There is a high concentration of use of technology when it comes to web archiving, and also a set of common practices. So there is Heritrix. Hands up if you have heard about Heritrix before. Okay, so not very many. So that's a software which is used to send requests to servers on the web. If you want to archive a website, you construct the web crawler to send a request to the web server where the content is held, and then you get the content back, get a copy back if it works. So that's how web archiving is done. It's, I think, at the most basic level, records of HTTP transactions between two servers. That's how I usually view it. So that's mostly, I think, I think 80-90% of the organizations doing web archiving rely on Heritrix one way or other. So there is a big reliance there on the Internet Archive. And there is also Umbra, which is a extended module to help Heritrix to render content websites as the browser would do, then you record that traffic. So this is really like an extended module to archive a more difficult website. There's the Wayback software, which is different from the Wayback machine. That's the rendering tool for archived web material. And then there is Nutchbox and Solr, both open source to help with full text and metadata search. And archived web pages are also stored in a format called WARC, which is the archival format and the ISO standard. At the same time, it actually compresses the archived material and also allows you to record relevant information relevant to the crawling process in the headers so that you can store them for the long term. So that really is, you know, the technology mostly used for archiving the web. So one interesting thing when it comes to web archiving is that apart from the Internet Archive, whose web machine has a global scale, everywhere else, web archiving is done from a national perspective, if not smaller. So which begs the question, you know, web as a global phenomenon, when we chop them up, each archive a piece of it, how do we know? You know, so you come to the almost like the end of the world, where, well, there isn't really an end of the world. You know, when my 11-year-old plays Minecraft, you know, he would say, when you reach the end of the world, turn left, you know? That way. So this is probably a attempt to turn left. So I'm not going to go into the details, but this is a lookup service developed by the British Library based on metadata aggregated from several web archives spread across the world. So it searches the Wayback Machine and also other major public web archives in the world. So, for example, I looked up the homepage of the National Library of Norway using this little service based on the Memento protocol. I actually can find out that this particular page, www.mb.no, has been archived 814 times in 10 archives. So I have the host table there, which tells me which archive it is. And I have some sort of graphical representation of where and during when these instances were archived. If I wanted to, I can go into the snapshot table and actually access each one of them. So this is great, right? So when you divide and conquer, you bring it all together again. But there are some issues here hidden. So I did say this is based on the Wayback Machine and also every major public web archive in the world. So I think Kirsty later probably could comment as to why or why not the National Library of Norway's web archive cannot be part of this. So I'll leave a cliffhanger there for you to think about it. So a little bit about the Internet Archive. It's a not-for-profit library established or funded in 1996 by Brewster Kyle, who's my boss. It's a digital library. It's located in San Francisco, and our mission is universal access to all knowledge. So I'm going to show you some numbers. When I worked at the British Library, you know, 150 million items, one of the largest libraries in the world. I thought I had a really big job. This is bigger. I'm not even going to read out these numbers. So 25 petabytes of digital resources, half of that is the archived web. So I think it's fair to say it's the largest, the Wayback Machine is the largest and the oldest web archive in existence, and it keeps growing. So a little bit more about the Wayback Machine. We do a lot of crawls on an ongoing basis. On a weekly basis, I think it's about 1 billion URLs being crawled. And there's also the Save Page Now feature, which I would like to highlight here. So if there is a page on the web which you'd like to save but have no other means, go to archive.org and find the Save Page Now feature. Put the URL there. It will be saved and made available in the Wayback Machine instantly. If you can program, you can interface and script around that interface. It accepts, a couple of thousand URLs per minute, so you won't bring down the service. just do that if there are things you want to save. And so in addition to the cross we do ourselves, we actually also receive donated cross or donated cross data from companies and libraries. The Wayback Machine you see is the Access Service, which was released in 2001. I was told that there are about 600,000 visits a day, and there are probably 480-plus billion URLs in there. That number keeps changing. This slides were, I think, I stole from the IPC General Assembly, so it's about a month ago. It probably has increased again. And we have content in 40-plus languages, 100-plus million websites. So it has become a rich source of historical information and supported researchers and users worldwide. This may not be directly relevant to you, but I think I should mention this in that the Internet Archive has worked with many national libraries and archives since the year 2000. We actually crawl for quite a few national libraries their national domain for them. A general impression of the Wayback Machine is that it's a broad impression of a national domain, but not many people actually know when we crawl on behalf of a national library, it is actually done quite comprehensively, both in breadth and depth, in terms of the breadth and depth. So I've given some figures there. So if we looked at the non-specific crawls for the National Library of New Zealand, we're probably only looking at half of the content if we haven't, you know, in comparison with the customized crawls for them. So the libraries get not just the raw data, but also metadata index and data sets and reports, etc. So Archive-It, again, another service from the Internet Archive, 400-plus partners. It's probably interesting for you to know that among these 400 partners, mostly based in U.S., about 60% of them are university libraries, including all the U.S. Ivy League libraries. So I guess this, you know, if you ask why, you know, the location of the Internet Archive may play a role here, but also I think the structure of Europe in that sense, having a national library being the central or being the responsible organization for national heritage, perhaps works slightly differently in the US. I mean, the Library of Congress has that role too, but in comparison, I think that national responsibility is probably less. Rather, there is a more federated approach to preservation or heritage preservation in the US. That's my personal observation. Archive-It is a fully hosted web application for building web archive collections. So these are not whole domain crawls like .no. You crawl the whole Norwegian web domain, which has, I believe, 780 registrations. At the moment, 780,000 registrations at the moment. But Archive-It is a much smaller scale. It's usually based around certain event or theme, and then curators would select, you know, relevant website, including some social media presence, and then construct the crawler to go and crawl these content and, you know, add metadata, and then they can be accessed in the Archive-It, on the Archive-It website. So the Internet Memory Foundation in Paris has a similar setup and service to enable smaller organizations to undertake web archiving in this way. And we mentioned Heritrix, and there's also the Wayback. Both pieces of software were developed and released by the Internet Archive and widely used by the community nowadays. So that's the overview of the web archiving landscape and the Internet Archive. I thought I'd also talk a little bit about national libraries, who, you know, play a quite important role in web archiving. So the early adopters included the National Library of Canada, which later merged with Archives of Canada. And they started exploring electronic publications in 1994-95. And then the Australians and the Swedish, who sort of started web archiving after, not very long after Internet Archive started web archiving. So these projects I think, you know, this quote from the Swedish National Library actually sums up the early experience very well. Dealing efficiently with electronic publications was indeed a new challenge for the staff of the National Library. This, to some extent, is still true for some national libraries. One thing to note here is the difference in terms of the early approaches to web archiving. While the Australians and Canadian chose a selective approach, like building collections, choose a topic, the National Library of Sweden went the other way. They felt that, you know, not selecting is the most effective, because without knowing what is valuable, you just keep the whole thing. So they actually started doing hodometrar as early as 1996. So that's interesting to note. I think web archiving at some point got enmeshed with the development of non-print legal deposit. Anyone who doesn't know what legal deposit is? Oh, I should say the other way. Anyone who knows what legal deposit is? Yeah, so this is a library school, so I assume you do know what it is. So in the UK, the existing printed legal deposit legislations existed since 1672. So really an old piece of legislation. It got extended, like in many other countries, to include non-print publications, including the web. In general, the access to legal deposit material is restricted. In the UK, I'll talk a little bit about it. You can see the extent to which these restrictions are implied to content which was openly available on the web in first place. So for the Internet Archive, I recently finished a piece of consultation exercise with 30-plus national libraries and individuals, looking at the sort of requirements and how Internet Archive's service meet those requirements. I've included the URL there. Those who are interested looking at how web archiving is done at the national libraries can go there and find out a bit more. So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about the British Library. So prior to April 2013, we were trying very hard to put in place the non-print legal deposit legislations. I personally was quite involved in that process by talking to the government department and talking to publishers, trying to make sure that a balanced legislation would be in place. But prior to that, we actually had a web archiving program and used a permission-based approach to selectively archive UK websites. Even after the non-print legislation was in place, the permission-seeking process still continued, but in this case, not the permission to archive, but the permission to provide access beyond the reading rooms. So the legal deposit responsibilities in the UK are shared by 6 national libraries. So the British Library, the National Library of Wales, Scotland, and Cambridge, University Libraries, Bodleian Libraries at Oxford University, and Trinity College in Dublin, because of historical reasons, which I'm not going to go into right now. So that in itself brings complexity. Although the restriction is implied, to reading rooms only, but you still have to make all these material available in 6 different libraries and secure. And .uk, again, is the 4th largest domain in the world. I think since April 2013, the British Library has done 3 domain crawls and accumulated about 160 terabytes of data already, 8 billion resources, and they're committed to providing full text search to that material, so which is really not an easy task. So I mentioned the roles of other UK legal deposit libraries, collaboration throughout, we have trialed in the process. So I think I was in charge of web archiving at the British Library since 2008 till last year. So during that 8-year period, we have trialed various organizational models as well. And while we didn't have legal deposit, the focus was on access and use. So we trialed many resource level access and also analytics and visualizations of data. So the Memento lookup, which I just showed you, is one of the things we experimented. And we also got some funding from the UK Arts and Humanities Research Council, and did some, did a project with data from the Internet Archive. So I'm talking about the Buddha project, which has produced 10 very specific case studies and delivered a historical search engine, which is called Shai. So I have included, again, URLs there. I'm not sure if we have time to go and look into it. We probably could do some of that in the end. But, these case studies come from humanity researchers who have very specific research questions and trying to use archived website as a primary source to find their answers. I'm going to talk about one of them later on. So, legal deposit. Does it work? And how does it work? So I had Ian Milligan, who is a Canadian scholar, whose primary research focus was on historians using web archives. I had him visiting the British Library. I put him in front of a computer in our reading rooms, and I brought up the UK Web Archive interface. I said, there you go. So I was observing him next to him and seeing him struggling and, doing what he needs to do. He documented the user experience very detailed. I remember him, looking at me in the end and said, "Congratulations, you have managed to make a website more difficult to use than a book." In itself, it is a compliment. It's damn hard to do that, to remove all the interactivity, inherent in the website themselves. Because of all the very restrictive requirements on how the legal deposit web archive should be used, unfortunately, at least for now, the British Library's web archives, in the essence, are rendered images as PDFs with links. So you can't do much about it. So maybe, in itself, I'm not against legal deposit at all. I think it's a great thing. It's the only way which enables countries in the world to systematically collect web content at national scale. And at least the content at the British Library is discoverable. And also we did a lot of things. We demonstrated what you can do with such a great, data set, or such what you can do with the content. But the restrictions are not very easy, are not very helpful. So the physical, I think I can understand the physical restriction to libraries' premises, but, restrictions on reproduction, you cannot copy 20%, more than 20% of the work. How do you implement that technically? How do you only allow a person copy and paste 20% of a web page. It's difficult. You don't do it. And how do you make sure that two users cannot look at the same archived URL at the same time? So there's a single concurrent access requirements there as well. So that's actually led to the almost image-like rendering in a very in a environment. So these, hopefully these things will change and improve the usability in the long run. But from an organizational point of view, I felt that when I was there, things have really changed prior and to and after non-print legal deposit. Because after, you know, starting doing domain crawl at scale for legal deposit, operational issues became somehow a priority, and the research and development were pushed to the background. So there are really a lot of conceptual challenges here because we're relying on existing legislations, existing concepts, existing network of libraries and archives to do web archiving, which has advantages, but also it brings the discourses with it as well. So, you know, if we use the term web archive, but they are quite different from a traditional archive, not just because, you know, it contains digital material, but it's also, you know, the implied authenticity and integrity, how truthful an archive resource is to the original, and how inviolable this is against modification, you know, all these things that can probably no longer be automatically assumed when you deal with the web archive. And also, you know, the archived material are very different from the live web as well, and they're not the same as digitized material. So those who are interested can read the Danish scholars Brugger and Finman, who argue that these are actually reborn digital material, which has its own, you know, characteristics. I think from a traditional organizational point of view, the blurred distinction between publications, grey literature, and records has also brought about confusion and responsibilities. You know, is it the archives or the libraries who are responsible for archiving the web? And when you both feel you're responsible, how do we make sure we work together and not feeling about stepping on each other's toes and that sort of issues? And there are additional boundary issues we touched upon as well. You know, the web actually doesn't really end, yet, you know, we're taking a very national approach to archiving the global web. You know, for most countries, the legislation would say it's the content on the ccTLD, the top level domain, which is in scope. And the content which is not on the ccTLD, some content is also in scope, but the definition of that is very inconsistent and difficult to implement. In the UK, I think the law says something like everything which is .uk and everything which is not UK but produced by a UK person or organization. So try implement that technically. I'm not sure what the Norwegian definition is there. Kirsty will probably mention that. So that's the bit which is very difficult to implement. The technical challenges, I think, unfortunately, while any modern browser would have no problem rendering virtually any web page, our purpose-built crawlers actually will quite often be defeated by the same web pages. So we have a lot of content gaps in the web archives. JavaScript, streaming media, password-protected content, content behind paywalls, forms, database-driven, robots.txt exclusions. The list goes on. That's why when you go to a web archive, you see gaps. You see elements of a page not there. Or you see a click on a link, you see a resource not in archive message. Yeah. And also the social media, which is a new class of content, which has additional challenges. We mentioned the challenges brought about by scale, you know, 8 billion pages you have to index them and support the search. I think at the moment the Bridge Library is doing that, I think, okay. But then considering that there are not many people using the Web Archive, so there is still probably a long way to go running it as a live service. But I think, you know, they'll get there eventually. So we actually are looking at quite a quite a lot of complexity if you look at the end-to-end web archiving process. I don't know. So the temporal inconsistency is something is an example I intended to cover. But I think it's actually quite a serious issue, which probably not a lot of people is aware of it. It's also called temporary inconsistency or violation. Basically, when a single page is marked with a single date time, it doesn't necessarily consist of resources which were crawled at the same time. So the Wayback software is trying to be helpful to fetch content which are hosted on the same URL but could be crawled at a different time to patch together a page for you. So as a result, you actually could be looking at pages from a web archive which were never existed. So I think there's some research done by Old Dominion University researchers. They sampled in 2014 about 4,000 web pages from a web archive and concluded that at least 5% has temporary violation. So a temporal span of weeks and months is quite common between the oldest and the newest element on a rendered page with a single date time. But in the most extreme cases, this measure, this oldest and newest element between two on the same page could be 5, even 10 years. We have found evidence in the Icelandic web archive where the frame set, the main frame, was archived like 8 years ago, while the frame content came from a crawl 8 years later. So I think in itself, if the users are aware of these things, fine, they can deal with it. If you go to the Memento time travel website, there's an option actually you can choose to reconstruct the website in that way or not. So if you choose to see the holy pages, the pages with the hole as it was archived, you could see it. And if you choose to see a reconstructed website with elements from other crawls, you can see it. But my point is, you know, these things are not explicitly said, not explicitly explained. So if you Googled me and the unknown aspects of the web, there's a more detailed write-up about that problem, should you be interested. Right, so I was told that there are many curators in the audience. So when we talk about web archiving, we probably can't avoid talking about the legal challenges either. So obviously, despite being openly available, copyrighted material on the web, but people look at fair use and implied license to try to preserve the web. And the web contains libelous or defamatory content. And it also contains, illegal content. There's personal data. There's porn, all kinds of things. And people also ask us, how about our right to be forgotten, when I worked at the British Library, my standard response would be, this is really not about rights to be forgotten. This is perhaps about the rights to be remembered when we talk about non-print legal deposit. And there is also the robots.txt. If you followed, quite often you don't get anything. If it disallows, if you followed robots.txt, you bring back a blank page. If you don't follow, you go into crawler traps. Crawler could be in a loop and, never comes back kind of thing. So, and also there is, I think a lot of web archives operate a notice and take down process to deal with that sort of issues. I think I'll give you a very interesting real world example where when I worked at the British Library, There's one instance where the British Library crawler went to visit a website and by accident deleted 128 pages from that website, which should really never happen because it's an HTTP GET request should really not change. It should not lead to that sort of behavior. So basically by following a link, a script was triggered and consequently deleted the website. So the website owner rightly got in touch with the developer, actually sued the developer, went to the small claims court, and I think won in the end. But she came to us, one, to ask us, you know, what did your crawler do? Can you give us logs and show us what your crawler did? And two, do you still have the content? Actually, I've lost it. If you have a copy, can I have a copy back? So, yes, we had those pages. But I can't just give it to her, can I? I couldn't, because there was legal deposit material. How does she prove that she owned this content? She indeed was the person she said she was. It was at least 2 weeks of work, working with lawyers, writing policy papers, and sending papers to committees to get that proved. I think in the end, we settled on Whois Record, which has a unique company number, which linked that to this lady's company, and she presented a company house registration. Unfortunately, she was the sole owner of the company. I was told if she was a co-owner, it would have been more, you know, difficult. You would have to get consent from the other owner as well. But, you know, just an example to show how complex sometimes it can get when it comes to web archiving. So I think we actually touched upon this a little bit already, the organizational and curatorial challenges. You know, web archiving requires a hybrid of skills, which in general are not supported by the libraries, national libraries' existing organizational structure. When you work with people, collaboration is great, but it really is complex and it makes things more difficult. And also we talked about the selective approach to web archiving. It has always really kind of puzzled me. I mean, to me, if you select something, you know, I select, you know, three cups from the pile, I see the pile, I know what I'm selecting from. So I'm consciously selecting something and deselecting something else. But I think when it comes to selecting websites for web archiving, you don't have that you don't have that luxury. So are we biased when it comes to selecting? Are we talking about the gaps? You know, are we aware of the gaps and overlap when we select, you know, build a web archive collection? Is it just random? You know, the curator's subjective view on the world? It may be. But I don't know how else, you know, we do that. You know, maybe automation can help to a certain extent, but I think the end of the day, the web is massive. You can only do your best. How about authenticity? You know, we talked about the temporal violation. What are we looking at? You know, does it still constitute as a copy of something, or is that something of its own right? Conceptually, I don't know. And all the curatorial effort, you know, adding metadata, describing selected website, and even quality assurance, which currently broadly still is based on visual comparison, they don't scale up. When you have to deal with billions of pages, the most pragmatic way of dealing with some issues, for example, a spelling error in the metadata, is to ignore it. You can't, unfortunately. And there's also the web, you know, grows, and the cost grows. And when I spoke to the National Libraries just recently, I think there's a widely observed budget cuts, making it really difficult for some libraries to sustain the ongoing development of necessary tools for the web. We're basically in an arms race with the web technology. You know, you resolve one issue, something new comes along, you have to look into that again. And, you know, we talked about the access and use. Dark archives are not helpful. And also currently how the web archive is organized. It mostly focuses on URL-based discovery, for example, the Wayback Machine. You have to know the URL to find a copy of that in the web archive. So I mentioned the how a lot of unknown characteristics of the web archives are not explained or explicitly stated. So I have included the URL there. And, you know, when the opposite is also true, at the British Library, feedback from researchers is that, oh, you know, your full-text search is great. You know, it's better than URL-based search, but I can't deal with 500,000 results, you know? And there are, you know, by running this research, these research projects with researchers, we realized that, you know, there are many methodological challenges too. You know, researchers don't necessarily know how to deal with this kind of material. There isn't a commonly agreed method to use that. So I give an example here, which is from Richard de Swart. He works at the University of East Anglia, and he was one of the Buddha Project participants. He intended to look at examining the historical UK web material and to understand the Euroscepticism, how that evolved, you know, on the UK web space. He wrote a very honest and very detailed report, you know, documenting his successes and failures. And I think it's really very valuable, you know, when we don't know how to use web archives and, you know, to see their thinkings and struggles. And I think using web archive as primary source for research is still quite speculative and experimental, as showed by Richard. And there are unexpected pitfalls and challenges in using web archives and digital web big data. There is also, you know, serendipity mentioned by Richard, which the unexpected findings and discoveries. But he also asked himself the question, you know, am I sort of defined? Do I have a fixed Google mindset? When I use the web archive and do the search, am I expecting Google-like results? Or is it, you know, the sort of digital methods such as textual analysis, corpus linguistics, data manipulation, and clustering algorithms, which he doesn't have in-depth knowledge about, is that the reason of his observed failure? So it's I recommend, if you're interested, you know, I recommend this report and to look at some of these questions raised by him, which is very illuminating. So far, I think there is an increasing interest from researchers. We have observed many different types of research interest. I think in general, the shift, it's in the spectrum between distant reading and big data analysis. I think that's a fair summary of, you know, the kind of research interest we have observed. So I'm going to give you a couple of examples. This is work based at the L3S Research Center in Germany, Hanover, Leipzig University, under the leadership of Professor Wolfgang Nigel. So this interface, again, there's a URL. I'm going to leave these slides to you so you can see you can go there. So this is actually built on top of the Wayback Machine. So we just mentioned in the Wayback Machine, you have to know the URL, right, to find the material. But you don't always know the URL. There isn't a full-text search available. Even if there is one, you probably will complain, oh, there are too many results. So this is probably a solution to that problem. So what they have done is they've developed the experimental search functionality for the Wayback Machine. And they have, and the search is actually based on entities. So all the entities available on Wikipedia in English and German are used as search terms. So you'll be prompt. When you type something in the search box, you'll be prompt. Either it's, you know, name, place, an entity, and then it will lead you to the Wayback Machine relevant to that. You know, once the search results is actually, and a ranking is based on bin, so take into account only those archived in the Wayback Machine. Where possible, it also gives you a URL on the live web. So the same people, they have, I don't know, 100, you know, over 100 PhD students working there. You know, the sort of resources which is very, you know, makes me very envious all the time. What they've done is also they have taken all the archived collections and made this archive web interface. This is a step further. They went through quite thorough requirements engineering, and they really looked at researchers' requirements in how they want to make use web, make use of web archives. So in here, you can search across multiple web archive collections, as in the Internet Archive's Archive-It collection, in conjunction with the live web. And you can the resources are grouped for creating, merging, collections. You can even expand the existing collections and add resources to it. And you can exchange notes, pull together your own corpora. So it's really, add comments and tags. It supports collaboration, supports corpora formation, it supports commenting, and also it blends in the live and the archived web. So you have to register to get access, but again, I've included the URL there, so that's actually a link. So they'll let you in, have a look, and see how it works. For example, here I searched Yugoslavia, and I can see, you know, a number of search results coming up. I know the green one points to an archived web, and then the next I focused on one of the archived pages. I didn't go to any of the live web page, and then I can see the metadata. You know, who archived this page, where it came from, when it was archived. So just to give you an idea of how a web archive research interface could look like. So again, this is more probably distant reading. You know, you try to find a specific page, you do something with it. But the next piece of work I'm going to briefly mention is slightly different. So this is work by Anat Ben-David, who used to work in the Netherlands, but now affiliated with the Open University of Israel. So the .yu domain was deleted from the internet root zone in 2010. At its peak, it hosted 70,000 websites. Overnight, all gone, links broken, you know, it doesn't exist anymore. So Anat tried to reconstruct the former Yugoslavia internet domain using she used various sources and generated a list of URLs of the .yu domain, including Wikipedia, and then she extracted all the outlinks to the .yu domain from archived pages in the Wayback Machine, and she did that repeatedly, actually without any detailed help from the Internet Archive, you know, using the API all by herself and her research students. So in the end, she recovered a data set containing 1.9 million unique pages, which were once hosted on the .yu domain between 1996 and 2010. which according to her is about 50% of the once existed domain. So this, which is shown on the, this graph. Some she knew about their existence, but they were not in the web archive. And the blue ones were found in the archive. And once she has got the data set reconstructed, she actually did some interesting analysis. This shows the evolution of the linking structure of the .yu website in the entire reconstructed space between 1996 to 2010. So the blue indicates websites in the .yu domain. All the other domains are marked in gray. And the visualization shows that how the link structure intensified, you know, over the year. So for those who are interested, I think I have included more information here, so you can go and read in detail how she has done her work. I have I happened to review one of her forthcoming papers. She actually has taken this forward. She was looking at, she has isolated images from the same data set, looking at whether the web design color used in the .yu domain, whether that's related to the former Yugoslavia Republic's national flag. You know, how the color relate to them. Very fascinating research. And also I would like to point you to a website, which is Web Archives for Historians. And there you can find a lot of work. There's a very active research community out there who started to use web archives and think about some of the issues we mentioned previously. I guess, you know, we have really learned some lessons, which in turn has changed how we archive the web. You know, it's really not easy to support research. You know, for a starter, it's a learning process for both parties. Some researchers don't always know what they want, and they by default want access to all data, but when they're told, well, that data set you're after, it's about 7 terabytes. Oh, you know, it's the scale as well. And not all of them have the technical resources or the knowledge or the support. So that really, that level varies. So I think we need to put in place some basic data analysis tools and also more data, especially in the case of the Internet Archive. It really doesn't equal better data. You know, sometimes it's a burden, you know, all that data. So we need the ability to help researchers create and manipulate corpora derived from a larger data set. And also, I think there needs to be some guidance, not necessary from the archives, maybe among themselves, from research institutions, about the ethical implications of this kind of research, you know. All in all, I think our challenge is to make everybody happy, which isn't very easy. I guess flexible services really is the key, and we're starting to look at how we do that. So the Internet Archive typically, you know, get involved with various types of research projects, you know, all kinds of institutions. You know, I mentioned L3S already, and our collaboration with the JISC, you know, many, and the RESOL initiative in Denmark, who's in the process of archiving a massive EU grant. Hopefully they will be successful, and there will be another major web archiving project in Europe. I think what I want to mention is the Archivet Research Service, where, you know, libraries have used Internet Archive Service to build collections. We have attempted to generate standard data sets to support some research effort, you know, entity, you know, geo data, and also metadata, you know, key metadata, so that you don't have to necessarily always deal with the WARC files, the original archival files. You have the essential data required to do that sort of analysis. And the Wayback Machine, you know, it's only discoverable using a single URL. We're making changes to that as well, supported by a grant. So there is actually a beta available, which I can't make, we're not making available yet, which allows you to show, to see the provenance of a certain page, you know, how is it crawled, what collection it is, and who did it, and when, and all that. So that hopefully will be helpful, but, you know, and also we're rewriting the Wayback software. We're hoping to optimize the scope and quality of what we crawl, so we don't, you know, we'll make sure that our resources are used to crawl the meaningful and interesting content more. And the playback or replay of rich media and interactive websites, that certainly needs to be improved. You know, we mentioned content gaps earlier. Quite often it's because the content was not captured, but sometimes the content is there. It's just the replaying software is not up to scratch to display that. And also, I think we are a long way from full text search of the Wayback Machine, considering how much it is. But there is a prototype of keyword-based search based on home pages, which, you know, is a great help, I think. And also, we're working with, for example, other services like the Wikipedia, which has a robot going around the Wikipedia itself and look for 404 or broken links. And once that's found, and it looks for a page in the Wayback Machine, and you probably, you know, look, if you look carefully, follow some of the links in Wikipedia pages, you already see redirect to the Wayback Machine if that link is dead on the live website. All right, I don't know how I'm doing in terms of time. I think I'm probably doing okay. So this is the last slide. 20 years of web archiving. Have we archived the internet? I think we have archived a portion of the web, and hopefully it will be there. There is increasing awareness and a growing community involved in web archiving. Like I said, the legal issues are much better understood, and there is a high concentration of use of technology and practice, but the web archiving landscape in essence is still quite uneven. So you have the Internet Archive playing an important role on one hand. On the other hand, you have a lot of US organizations and European organizations involved in web archiving. The rest of the world is still quite a, you know, piece of blank sheet of paper. And we have noticed scholarly use of web archives. They start to emerge, but it's hard to support all the requirements, and they're learning to use this kind of material as well. Before we settle on standards and common practices, I think what the web archives can do is to maximize transparency and make some baseline knowledge self-explanatory. You know, it's okay if there are gaps. It's okay if there are temporary violations. Tell people. We probably need to think about derivation, portability, and access and use. You know, unlike printed material, you know, we have seen how working with researchers and focusing on access has taught us, you know, things and how it changed our archiving practice. And we need to think about partnership and also decentralization. I think the world with just one archive is risky. We need redundancy. And also we probably need to think about using standards and web technology to support web archiving. You know, if the browser renders all the pages and gets all the content, why can't we use browser-based crawling? You know, which is already happening. Umbra, I mentioned earlier, is actually mimicking, you know, a headless browser to try to get some of the more difficult content. I think what I can say also is that the full potential of web archives are yet to be exploited, and I'm looking forward to the next 20 years. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Helen. This is really interesting. We have time for questions or comments.
Yes, thank you for an interesting presentation. You mentioned briefly illegal content and also bias. Is there anything you don't want in the Wayback Machine? And how do you deal with it if it appears?
In the Wayback Machine. I think the... I'm not very familiar with the Internet Archive situation. I think I probably could answer that question better if I think about the British Library or the UK. So I know exactly what kind of... So there are four classes of illegal content in the UK. Some are illegal to possess. Some are illegal to possess and to distribute. Because the web crawling takes place at an arm's length. So we actually there's no human involved in the decision as to, you know... The decision is taken at arm's length, which content to pick up. It's the whole domain crawl, and also it was for the purpose of legal deposit. So it was okay if we, by accident, picked up illegal content. But I think it relies on flagging up by users, you know, should we come across that. At the British Library, I think we had... meetings with the Information Commissioner's Office, with the Internet Watch Foundation, just to deal with that kind of issues. As for the Internet Archive, I think there are colleagues who specifically deal with this kind of issues. I'm not aware of a specific statement as to what content we don't want or we want, but I do know that because of the scale we deal with quite often, you know, there is a notice and takedown process if there is content being flagged by you, so everyone can flag up content and it will be examined and quite, you know, if it's valid that access to that content will be blocked. Hope that answers your question.
Anyone else?
Can you say something about the deduplication? How do you avoid to harvest the same content when you harvest one site at the same time? That's a challenge for the National Library now.
Yeah, so deduplication, gosh, yeah. So where do I start? Web archiving is not quite often, in general, not a one-off thing. You go to the same website at different time intervals, so it's very often you pick up the same content. So there are a number of disadvantages of that. One, you have to store the same content unchanged, and it, you know, occupies your disk space. It costs money. Two, when you look at the sort of analysis, you know, big data analysis, it could skew your data. Because, for example, a simple example would be if you search key terms, how many times does this term occur in this web archive? If you're counting duplicated pages, you could skew the results. So that's why it's desirable to deduplicate. But it's not a very easy thing to do. So I think there are reported issues when it comes to access after deduplication. But I think the infrastructure is there. So, for example, the WARC standards allows you to record the deduplication process by allowing you to record in the WARC headers the revisit record. So if you end up pointing to the same copy, but conceptually have a few different records pointing to the same physical copy, that's okay. So that's what Kirsty was talking about, I think, deduplication. At the British Library, when I left, I think they were in the process of a third domain crawl. The previous two domain crawls were not deduplicated. I'm not entirely sure about the Internet Archive. I think some sort of deduplication takes place, but I don't know the details. I need to find out. So that's probably something I need to email you about. Okay.
We have time for one or two more.
I take questions in Norwegian. Which you will translate for me. Okay, right.
Okay. Thank you again so much.
Welcome.